And so I thought I would talk first a little bit about John Locke's conception of property and how we come to have a right to property. And I choose Locke for a couple of reasons. One, because at least in terms of a kind of the European legacy of this country, I think he's probably more influential than anybody else on this point. And in part, that is because he really felt that defending a notion of individual property, especially having land as property, was constitutive of being able to defend against tyranny. Right, that this was really important for individual freedom to be able to like appropriate land for yourself and guard it against.
Could you just give us a background on Locke?
Yeah, Locke. Okay. so I'm trying to remember his dates. I'm really bad with dates.
That's okay. Just a little background. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So sort of. Born during basically the English Civil War in the 17th century, or around about, again, I have to remember his exact birth date, was a large, what was he by trade? He's actually a doctor by trade, but became a large defender of the English Glorious Revolution and then the restoration of the monarchy, but was a pretty influential writer on politics, on toleration. Actually, he wrote a pretty famous work on toleration for different religions under the crown. Everybody but Catholics, because they couldn't be trusted. And they were totally loyal to the Pope for his tastes, but for Protestant toleration. So most of the personal life had a few, I guess, avenues to be influential in power, but was a doctor and was actually a private tutor and doctor to a relatively powerful aristocrat in his house. So, but yeah, that era, I know more, probably he, never mind. Okay. I probably know more funny things about Locke's life than I know about personal life. For instance, he was definitely having, sort of romantically involved with the lady of his house, and her husband didn't seem to mind this. There's all kinds of questions about why. But anyway, so Locke, terribly influential on somebody like Jefferson. I mean, in terms of coming into our country. The whole idea of kind of life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, really a kind of Lockean idea. And wrote one of the a work called The Two Treaties of Government, which was terribly influential on somebody like Jefferson. So he's this kind of major Enlightenment figure, seen as, you know, somebody who's forward thinking in terms of at least moving towards a kind of more democratic understanding of land rights, if not political structure, and of having sort of forward thinking ideas about toleration, about the rise of science, about making Christianity, in his lens, more sort of focused on ethics and focused on sort of religious warfare and these sort of institutional sorts of things. So he writes in The Two Treaties of Government, in one of the first chapters, that two things are required in order to sort of appropriate land as your own and to claim it as property. And they're both problematic, and they have problematic histories, which is why I kind of want to bring them out as questions today. The first thing he says you have to do is you have to mix your labor with the land, right? So one thing you have to do is you have to mix your labor with it. And this is justified for him on the basis of the idea that the first thing we actually have property over is our own bodies. So our first piece of property is our body, which is something I've honestly struggled with for a long time a little bit, because I don't know that my primary understanding of my embodiment is as property. I don't know that would be kind of a Crow understanding. I don't know if it's the only way to look at how our relation to our bodies. But I also find it hard to argue against, because at the very least, our body seems to be something that we can defend against the claims of others, right? If somebody tries to claim a right to my body, I have the right to defend that. And so Locke says, you know, it's my property in that regard. And so if we mix our property through our labor with land, that's the first step of sort of claiming it as our own. And the second thing that's needed, and this is quite vague, but I think quite interesting, is it just says you have to leave as much and as good for others. So you have to be able, you mix your labor with land, and you leave as much and as good for others, then you can claim it as your own. So there is a kind of presumption in his work, I would say, of the idea that there will be common land, right? That if you take land, you must leave some common for others. A couple things maybe to say about that. One is that it's while I think interesting that it presumes a common, it's historically been used for all kinds of colonial justifications. Namely, that we will work this land better and we can push you off this land and we'll leave that stuff over there for you and that's as much and as good for you, but we can work this better and mix our labor with it more. So Locke was very friendly to private property and very unfriendly to indigenous land rights, with the presumption that indigenous peoples weren't working the land as well as they could. They weren't engaged in agriculture. They weren't engaged in sort of mining and industry. And so we're going to mix our labor with it. You're not mixing enough of your labor with it, and we're leaving as much as good for you over there, and we can kind of push you off your land. So I think that has a kind of really complicated history, and I always like to be honest about that. There's a lot in Locke and his understanding of property that's been used for pretty nefarious ends. But I do think this is, it's still in some ways, you can look at the history of homesteading, you can look at even how public lands are oftentimes defended. I think this is the kind of dominant idea we have of when you have a right to property, right? You're doing something with it, and you're leaving enough for others. Even if you look at sort of the establishment of things like national parks, right? We're going to do something with this to allow people to enjoy it and have scenery, and we're going to leave this other land for people to work. So one thing I wanted to ask, and I guess I start here with Locke because again, I don't know that there's a good basis in this country for engaging these questions of public and private lands without at least acknowledging that this is in some part our legacy of these twin ideas of working land and leaving as much and as good for others. But the questions I want to push is, in some ways, I think when we enter an age where it's not really clear what leaving as much for others would mean. There's 7 billion people on Earth. And you can work large swaths of land because of industrialization and machinery. And exactly what it means to leave as much as good for others has long been one of the sticking points in the discussion of property. One, what as good means is really unclear when you get into sort of environmental destruction and things like this or downstream effects. And what as much means is also problematic because people can work much larger tracts of land than you could Locke's time. So I think that's problematic, but I also, and I guess this is the point I just want to leave in people's heads on this first stop. I don't wonder if this idea of leaving as much and as good for others couldn't be kind of productive for us as we think of the intersection between private and public lands. So one of the things when Marisa contacted me, I started looking into, I was like, well, what goes on when people actually have to work at these intersections? And many of you probably know more about this than I do, but I looked at some examples of sort of land expropriation, right? When people actually have to take land back from ranchers and farmers to make migratory paths for animals or these sorts of things. And I looked at sort of what was effective in many of these cases. And one thing that's always needed is what philosophers oftentimes refer to as kind of distributive justice rights, right? So that would be the idea that I need to be compensated for whatever you take from me. This is economic justice, right? So if I'm going to sort of distribute some of my land back to you, you need to compensate me for this. So that's always sort of step one when we look at these issues. But what a lot of researchers are finding is that just as important for making this effective is what are oftentimes referred to as procedural rights, right? That involving people in a process, that people don't feel that their land is expropriated from them without them being involved in conversations, in sort of discussions over why this is the case. And this is where I started thinking again about some connection back to Locke, that if we can bring people into these processes and really talk about what it means collectively to actually leave as much and as good for others in this kind of very complex environmental landscape and very complex legal landscape, I think, that we live in, that this might be a productive means of starting a conversation. Again, not just property as something we work, not just property is something we appropriate, but property is something that presumes that there's going to be as much and as good left for other people to enjoy, work, etc. Yeah, please.
Did Locke just mean enough for humans?
Yes. Probably. Yes. Yes.
That's what I was
gonna say. No. Okay. So, yes. there's been a lot of ink spilled on sort of exactly what as much and as good for others means, right? Because what does as much mean, number one, right? He's, and again, he is somewhat, I think, problematically envisioning the beginning of the British Empire, and there's all this land out there, right? There's all this land for the taking. So sure, you can take this as your property, and sure, the king shouldn't have his hands in it, because look, there's all of this, you're making it better, you're increasing productivity. The place I think that's interesting to think about, and again, I have no desire to rescue Locke here, but I want to give him at least his due on if we start to think of as good, right? What does as good mean? There might be a foothold for a kind of environmental ethic there. Right, because I think we have very different understandings of what it might mean to leave as good for others. And we have much better understanding of what destroying land permanently looks like, and not leaving as good for others through our labor. So I don't know that Locke himself had this in mind, because I don't think he could foresee the environmental degradation that is post-industrialism. He's kind of pre-industrial England. He's starting to see some of that, but he's not really Charles Dickens era, smog over London. But I think if we think of what it means to leave as good for others, there might be something there. Yeah,
My problem was that, and I haven't read a lot of him, but just a little bit, basically something like this would be antithetical to him, because he basically said, if you're not working the land, you're not, doing agriculture or mining or something like that, it's basically an affront to God. That's like, you've got to be, the land must be productive.
Correct.
To humans.
Right.
And so, yeah, and to Marie's question, it's like, well, nature is just something to be exploited rather than something that has value on its own.
Okay,
well,
good.
There's a more interesting story there. So he's apparently having an affair with his patron's wife.
Yeah.
Who is an aristocrat living on a huge piece of land where he's doing no labor.
Oh, that's
on
true.
That land. Although he probably, and this I think is really important actually to even our discussions politically today. I'm sure that aristocrat thought of himself as contributing to the commonwealth through the industry of his estate. He had all these people farming for him. Mm-hmm. He was, a very wealthy person, but he was putting a lot of money back into the system. And this whole debate about when can the tyrant come and take this away from me, which we might see now as the 1% having an argument, is really still the same argument I think we're having today, about who gets to decide. But when you first mentioned Locke talking about leave, use the land but leave for the others. And I've been hiking in Scotland, and they have these laws where if country's been open space walkable for hundreds of years, it still is. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if maybe that might have been in his mind, and why you can go to England and Scotland and still see these open rural places, because part of what that culture was saying is that, yeah, you can work the land, but you can't stop people from walking this trail we've been walking for the last 10 generations. Mm-hmm. Which gets into some really interesting ideas, I think, about how long people have been in a place and how that affects how we have these conversations.
No, I think it's possible. I mean, I don't see a whole lot in Locke's text. I mean, I see more of God wants you to work everything. Although I don't know exactly what he has in mind. But to your point,
it's interesting to look at English common law from those times because our public land issue is about access to these lands. And how different is that than...
But that's kind of different in every different community. Like in Hawaii, you can't own the beach, right? You always have to grant access to the beach. And that comes from the community presumably living off the ocean and stuff like that. Whereas in other states in the U.S., it's like you own a piece of property, you can do what you want with it. And so that's a kind of community decision.
Montana has public waterways like that. Yeah, you can walk up any stream you want.
Right in the middle of it.
You own that.
Right.
My question is like this term that we use now, I don't know how long it's been in use, but in perpetuity. And so when we have like conservation easements like we have on this land, you can sign a document and say how that land will be used in perpetuity, mm-hmm. and it can't be used for development. You can't subdivide this anymore because it's in an easement. And it's been around at least for a long time because, you know, treaty rights, I guess like the 1855 Fort Laramie treaties would also be in perpetuity, like it grants certain amounts. It wasn't just like, we're going to pay you this mm-hmm. amount right now and that's it. It's like in perpetuity, you know, education and healthcare and food and mm-hmm. things like that. I guess my question is like, where does that fit in with property and things like that?
I think it's, and I don't know a whole lot about the history of how that these concepts developed, right? And again, I'm glad there's some discussion because again, I'm not trying to say Locke has the right conception, but I do think it's the same issues we're dealing with. What does this good mean? What do we do this in perpetuity? It's hard. I even struggle with the concept. I like it. I like what it does, right? So as a kind of consequentialist thinker, I like that these lands are going to be forever here. The fact that somebody in a current generation can bind future generations and how they choose to use land, I think is actually really hard to fit within this framework.
I think it's pretty loosely.
What's that?
It's been used pretty loosely in treaties.
Yeah.
And broken just as easily.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's actually a hard rights concept. I think it's a pretty productive one, and I think for these reasons, right? We want to preserve kind of access. We want to preserve this sort of idea that there's as much and as good for others, and you know, not everybody has to do that, right? So it is an exercise of freedom, right? Like just because you're kind of committing your land to this doesn't mean I have to, and it fits, I think, within a lot of our rights frameworks. I do wonder sometimes how that within a pure sort of enlightenment and individual rights framework works, though, that we could bind generations 100 years from now on what they can
right,
do with the land.
Because it's a human law, it can be uprooted. I mean, the Crow Reservation is a good example. The river was condemned, right, and a big dam was put in against the treaty and against the rights of the people who lived on the Crow Reservation, just as one example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the people in power can come in and say, well, perpetuity, but we need this for the common good. Mm-hmm. It's usually what's stated,
right.
And then it's taken away from
the people
who thought
they
had it for
doesn't
perpetuity.
Doesn't that come back to a collective? Didn't we elect those people?
Yeah.
So isn't this on the other side of the coin, then? Is you say binding generations maybe is a problem, but the community, like the nation, did it when they bought Yellowstone Park. So if the state and the county have decided this is a good thing, until the state and the county decide otherwise, it should hold.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean that sort of the community at large needs to continue to support that goal, or they can change it.
But if you think about the word, like perpetuity, that's a like pre-Lyell, pre-Darwin steady state universe thinking, like the world was created, okay, and if you go back far enough, half of Montana was underwater because it was an ocean, so, and if you go back farther than that, you know, the continents moved, and so they thought of the world very differently than we understand it now, so that concept of perpetuity comes from the thinking where the earth is created and it's basically stopped in the middle.